Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for a Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Lorraine Devon Wilkie. She is a former rock and roller, a longtime Huffington Post contributor, and the author of the acclaimed novel, After the Sucker Punch. Lorraine and I will be discussing her personal journey as a writer, photographer, singer-songwriter, and her latest novel, Hysterical Love. Good morning, Lorraine. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Great, Johnny. Thank you for having me on. I'm really happy to be here.
Wonderful. It is a pleasure to have you on the air with me. Hysterical Love is a wonderful, entertaining read. The book is beautifully written. It's very engaging and a definite page-turner. So congratulations.
Thank you. I'm really glad you liked it, and thanks for taking the time to read it.
Great. Wonderful. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, I was born in Chicago. I grew up in Illinois, in northern Illinois, in a little farm town called Richmond. I suppose the most remarkable thing about my childhood is that I'm one of 11 children, which is pretty remarkable. had a lot to do with my creativity because I came from a very creative family. And then at some point I migrated west. I was in a rock and roll band in the middle of my college. I was a theater major at the University of Illinois, and I got in a rock and roll band. Such a cliche and such a fun cliche. And I traveled west with the band and then just ended up staying in Los Angeles, and that's where I've been since my very early young adulthood, and came out here basically to pursue my creative life and ended up staying, and I'm still here. All my siblings are really creative people. My parents, my father is deceased, but both my parents are very creative. So I grew up in a family where there was lots of music and art and books and plays, and so it had was a great inspiration for me in pursuing the arts.
Very interesting. When did you discover you have a talent for writing?
I always liked writing, even in, you know, as a child, I liked the process of writing. But in terms of when I discovered I had a talent, and that's a funny and an interesting way to put it, because I think there is that discovery of a talent. You know, you don't necessarily know you have it until either somebody acknowledges it or you get a certain kind of acknowledgement for your work. And I think with my writing, that didn't happen until I was in Los Angeles, and I was working with a theater group, and I started co-writing screenplays and plays, and I started getting a sense that I kind of knew how to do this, and people wanted to do it with me, and that was fun because I realized I had a certain facility that I could put words to paper with a certain ease. So it didn't come till later. I think I discovered my talent for singing much, much earlier when I was warbling in school choirs and people told me, oh, you can sing good. But writing didn't come till a bit later.
Did you follow some of your favorite authors while you were growing up?
Well, interestingly enough, I was talking to a person about writers and about being a late bloomer, which I sort of consider myself to be a late bloomer in a lot of ways. I mean, I've been very creative and working in the artistic world for a long time, but I'm definitely my way in terms of exploring it on a more commercial end. And she said to me, look up late bloomers. And I looked up writers who were late bloomers, and one of them was Laura Ingalls Wilder, who, it turns out, didn't publish her first book until she was 65. And I found that very interesting because as a child, she was my favorite writer. I absolutely loved the Little House on the Prairie series. Obsessed by it. And so that was kind of an interesting and neat connection to make, to discover that this woman that I had loved reading when I was a child was considered a late bloomer. So it gave me lots of hope.
Very interesting. Why did you decide to become a storyteller?
I think because just the way my mind works, or the way who I am and what I think, it seems very important to me to express my feelings and thoughts about things. And I found that oftentimes it was the most effective and entertaining and engaging way to do that was through writing, through fiction, through telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I was enamored by storytelling as a reader, so it kind of just followed that I would find that inspiring to do as a writer. I like the format. I like that format for expressing ideas or sharing philosophies or digging into personalities or events that happen in life. I think it's a really interesting way to do it as opposed to, you know, the more non-fictional, instructional ways of expressing ideas. I think you can do a tremendous amount of inspiring within the realm of a really exciting page-turning story, and that kind of became the way I wanted to share my perspective on life through stories.
You are among 11 siblings. Were
yeah.
the other brothers and sisters as talented as you are in terms of writing and so forth?
You know, yeah, they all are really incredibly talented in their own ways, and it's an interesting mix of some of them are graphic artists. In fact, the cover of both my novels
mm-hmm.
were designed by my youngest sister, Grace Amandis, who is an incredible mm-hmm. graphic designer out of Chicago. I have a brother, Tom Amandis, who's a very successful actor and writer. I have sisters who are in the arts. One sister's a filmmaker, Louise. There's a lot of talent and creativity in my family, which is astonishing in a way. My brother Paul is a big Chicago actor.
Mm-hmm.
Very creative group. And I think that's because, you know, my father was very focused on us exploring the arts. At one point in my childhood, the TV was thrown out of the house, and we did not have a TV. And he would bring home boxes of books from the library, and we had our music was playing
mm-hmm.
24/7. Had a big influence on the way we view the world through that filter, that very creative filter.
Very interesting. Do you find yourself daydreaming a whole lot?
No, I don't. I think I'm honestly, this sounds so, maybe sounds stupid, but I'm too busy to daydream. I'm literally working from the second I get up till the second I go to sleep with all the things you do when you're an independent writer, with the writing and the marketing and the promotion and writing the new book and continuing to kind of keep plates in the air with my photography and my music. I would say the closest I come to daydreaming is I get out on power walks on a real regular basis, and I slap on a pair of headphones and I listen to great music. But when I'm in that zone is when my mind kind of goes and I start thinking about ideas or where I want to go or what I want to do. And oftentimes right before I go to sleep. So that's maybe not daydreaming, but it's a form of daydreaming that I lie in bed before I fall asleep and kind of picture something exciting that makes me feel good about my work and my life, and kind of sort of positive affirmations in a way, visualizations in a way, is the closest I'd say I get to daydreaming.
I see. Do you have a ritual that you follow? I know that some great writers have this thing that, okay, from this time to this time of the day, I'm completely in my zone and I'm just painting everything that comes to mind, so to speak.
No, I'm anti-ritual. I do understand people that like that and find that structure to be helpful. For me, there's no ritual whatsoever. I work on a laptop, so I
mm-hmm.
basically can work anywhere in the house, and I do. I work wherever I feel like working. I can work in the middle of noise and chaos, and I can work in total silence. So no, for me, it's really about, it's an internal inspiration. It's like channeling your muse. That's my only ritual. I don't subscribe to any others. I don't know why. It's not that I decided not
mm-hmm.
to. It just didn't happen. You know how some babies grow up and they don't need that little blanket, and then others do.
Yeah.
I just wasn't the kind who needed the blanket. So, which is good, I think. It lends me a lot of freedom because we travel a lot, and if I've got my laptop, I'm good to go. It doesn't matter where I am. So I think that's a good thing for me. It keeps me very free to work wherever I can and want to.
Is composing a song as challenging as writing a novel?
No, I mean, it can't be, simply because it's such a much shorter exercise. Writing a novel, of everything that I've done creatively, has been the most involving, just simply by virtue
mm-hmm.
of its size. You know, I mean, it's anywhere from, 300 to 500 pages, depending on how large yours are. Mine tend to be in the 320 range. And it takes time. It takes a tremendous amount of time. And it's very challenging to find the right rhythm and the right story arc. Whereas a song, which in my mind, my songs are little stories. They're exactly the same in fact that they have a beginning, middle, and end. They have a story arc, but they're only, you know, 3.5 to 5 minutes long. So you have a much, much smaller boundary in which to fit your story. So it's, in some ways, that's harder, though. You know, I mean, I'm reversing my answer here. It's not as challenging, but it has its own challenges in that you've got to fit in your beginning, middle, and end in the realm of 4 minutes and in the realm of rhyme and rhythm and repetitive lines. And it can't be too didactic or too literal. It has to have that sort of easy to listen to kind of verbiage. So, it has its own challenges. But, no, I wouldn't say it's as challenging as writing a novel.
That's interesting. What makes a good story?
I suppose everybody has a different answer to that question depending on what they like to read.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for me, I came up as a writer, you know, with the idea that a story arc kind of began with a premise that was engaging instantly, that you instantly wanted to know what happens here with this person. You created characters that they didn't have to be likable, but they had to be engaging, they had to be intriguing. And then you gave them lots of obstacles to deal with, lots of challenges, lots of tasks to accomplish or information to discover or challenges, like I said, or mysteries. And then you give them free rein and you allow them to kind of find their way. And then you have to have a resolution. I'm a big believer in resolutions. And by that, I don't mean tie them up neatly in a little bow Hollywood ending. I'm absolutely against that. But there's been several books I've read where you get to the end and it just ends. It's just over. And you're like, wait, what was the conclusion here? What was the period at the end of the sentence? And I'm a big believer that a good story leaves you with an emotional resolution. We don't need to have all the answers. We don't have to have writing off into the sunset. But we need to have an emotional resolution that makes the time we put into following these characters, it makes it worth something. It gives us something. It stays with us. I think a book that stays with you is the best kind of book. So I think it's all about that. It's all about deepening and entertaining, but giving people some kind of creative resolution that's very satisfying.
You're one of the few people that I know who enjoyed life in the sense of having the opportunity to be really involved with several different careers and thriving with them.
Yeah.
With the diverse background that you have and the vocation experiences that you have encountered, do they contribute to your writing at all?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was thinking about that yesterday because in Hysterical Love, the lead character is a photographer. And because of my experience in photography, I was able to infuse his life and his dilemmas and his frustrations with tremendous reality because I have experienced those things myself, and I have I have that knowledge and that background. You know, that old adage of writers write what they know is true. But of course, you know, if you're writing fantasy or you're writing paranormal romance or something, you've got to go well beyond what you know. But I think every writer infuses their stories with elements of themselves, of the world they live in, the people they know, the characters they've come across in their life. And when you've done lots of different things, like in my first novel, After the Sucker Punch, that the main character, the protagonist, is a writer, and she also has a background in music. It's not based on me specifically, but I was able to tap into my experience in both those realms to, you know, infuse her story with tremendous authenticity, I think. And so I think that's fun for me to have had so many experiences that I can talk about completely different avenues of life with some, you know, with some authenticity and experiential knowledge, and that I like that. You know, I can tap into a lot of family stuff because of my family situation. I can tap into a lot of spiritual, philosophical stuff because I was raised a Catholic. I got into Scientology. I got out of both. I've learned a lot about all of that. And those things are infused in my stories as well, particularly my first novel explores faith and cults and all of that very much. And it's great to have that kind of experience to tap into. It's like built-in, embodied research. So it's all good. It's really good.
How much research do you do before you write?
Very little, you know, because I'm writing novels. I'm not, you know, and most of what I don't cover anything that is particularly needing research. In my first novel, After the Sucker Punch, the writer writes a series of articles on father-daughter stories and covers a lot of sort of traumatic stories. And I did some research on that to find stories and find information that the character could infuse into her novels. But beyond, you know, like just looking up where, you know, like in Hysterical Love, mm-hmm. the protagonist goes on a road trip to Oakland. And so mm-hmm. I needed to know some things about Oakland that I didn't know. So I spoke to, I have a sister who lived in Oakland, and Eileen helped me, you know, understand more about Oakland. She understood more about herbs and tinctures, which is one of the characters in the book does that. So I may talk to people that have some experience and elements I want to give my character, but so far the books I've written themselves have conveniently tapped into my own experience enough that I haven't had to research beyond that.
How would you describe your style of writing?
You know, it falls into the traditional category of literary fiction in the sense that words are really important to me. Literary ideas are important to me. And so I write, I believe, with a certain depth, a certain richness. I know that may not be the right word, but it's very important to me to go deeper and to describe things in a way that kind of creates the visual, creates the sensorial experience of that thing, whether it's a visual or an action or a personality or an experience people are having. My style is, you know, contemporary literary fiction. It's real people in real life situations. I always, at least so far, have mixed humor in with drama.
Mm-hmm.
I have a short story called She Tumbled Down that is pretty much strictly drama. That's about a hit and run accident. So that's very, very dramatic. But both my novels are very, there's a lot of humor infused in the drama. But it's important to me to go deeper and to talk about topics of meaning and depth, even within the realm of a entertaining, even whimsical story, because mm-hmm. there are elements of Hysterical Love that are sort of whimsical and entertaining, but through the main character, I do explore issues related to family and relationships and death and one, you know, living life and life choices and, you know, all of those things that I think are very resonating and very recognizable to most readers. So, you know, to me, it's how do you explore those kinds of things, but in a very entertaining format, whether it's, you know, the drama of a person's life, which would be truer of my mm-hmm. first novel, or more of the whimsy and the wild ride of Hysterical Love. And that's just something that I find is important for me as a writer to infuse. So it's, you know, not every reader wants depth. You know, some people just want a nice story. But for those who want to go a little bit deeper and explore deeper ideas, I think my style of writing would probably be appealing.
Is there a special reason for you to sort of keep with the family parent-child relationship theme?
No, I mean, I have, that's a realm that I personally find utterly fascinating because, you know, every single human on this earth has some family relationship. And I think it is one of the most universal aspects of human life is our relationships with our families. And it just so happens that two books that I've written so far, and my next book is also going to tap into a family situation revolving very much around the world of rock and roll and the 80s and stuff like that. But I think, you know, for me right now, I've got some other ideas for further on down the line that are less family-oriented or more socio-political. These were stories that I had developed, especially Hysterical Love and my next book, were stories that I had developed years ago and into screenplays and loved them and got a tremendous amount of positive feedback for the stories themselves, but the scripts were never made, so I wanted to give those stories life, and so I'm transitioning them into novels. But once I'm done with the next one, I'm going to be exploring some other things that, you know, are more, like I said, socio-political. But I don't think that, you know, I think I will always deal mostly with relationships because that's what appeals to me. Mm-hmm. I'm not looking so much for the murder mystery or the science fiction. Those just aren't things I'm drawn to. And I think as a writer, we tend to write what we're drawn to as a reader. And that's what I'm drawn to as a reader, the real-life stories that like Pat Conroy and Leanne Moriarty write and Richard Russo and, you know, writers of that nature. So it's just a choice. It's not an exclusion. And if something came to me that was really inspiring to write and had zero to do with family, I would write it if it inspired me to that extent.
Very interesting. What is the inspiration behind Historical Love?
It was a story. You know, sometimes people tell you, you know, an anecdote of something they experienced or something they knew about, and it's so fascinating. And your mind kind of goes, what would happen if then this happened? Now, the famous what if. And this was a story that was shared to me by a man who talked about a son who had found the writing of his father and discovered that his father had a long lost love that he had many, many years earlier in his life before he was married. And this man was convinced that this long-lost love was the woman that his father should have been with. And he actually, in the story, the father had named the woman and where she lived, and the son tracked her down. He found her number through information, or at least a number through information. And he called her, and a woman answered the phone, and he panicked and hung up the phone and never called her back, and that was the end of his story. And my a friend of mine was telling me this, and I thought that was so strange and so interesting that an adult child would take something that far. And I thought, what if he didn't stop there? You know, what if he became so convinced that this was something that he needed to explore that he actually went to find her? And that idea just struck me as intriguing. And so that's really where the story started, was this anecdote that was shared with me. And my imagination said, well, let's just take it farther out. You know, let's go all the way. Let's get him looking for this woman, and then let's see what happens when he finds her. And that's what this story is about, this son reads. I mean, I've completely changed the original anecdote to fiction, but in the story, Dan McDowell, who's the protagonist, finds this story of his father who is very ill and decides that he thinks he hears his father saying her name in a state of unconsciousness and becomes convinced that this woman has the answers to life, has the answers to his father's life, to his life. He's just been dumped by his fiancée, and he's confused about love and relationships and growing up, and he gets this somewhat fanatical idea that this woman is going to have lots of answers. And so the book is his journey in both exploring those issues he's challenged by and going to find this woman. And it's got a lot of great twists, and the end is a little bit unexpected, but that's how the story got inspired.
I enjoyed the story that you told in the book. It's fascinating. It's very engaging, obviously, and it's easy to read. Very, very entertaining. It's sort of down-to-earth, everyday conversation. It's the approach of sort of a screenplay-type writing, which I really enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that when you read dialogue in a book, it should be just as real as if you were sitting in a room with those people and they were talking. And I think oftentimes, I mean, I have to thank my years of experience as a screenwriter, because with screenwriting you're mostly just writing dialogue. You know, you're writing dialogue and you're writing a setup, but you're not delving deep into a character's introspective thoughts or, you know, their background. You're exploring your character and the story of your script through the dialogue and through the action. So you have to get very good at finding ways to give your characters words that express the story. And so I think with as many years as I had writing screenplays, dialogue comes easily to me. I enjoy writing it. I feel like I'm just sitting in a room transcribing my characters. I don't feel like I'm giving them the dialogue. I feel like I'm sitting in a room and they're doing what they're doing and I'm just writing it down. That's how alive it all feels to me. And I think that translates to the page. As far as beyond the dialogue, I think that I'm just a writer that, you know, I picture, I'm writing a chapter and I get to the end of that chapter and my mind goes to what would be next? What would be the next thing you'd want to see? What would be the next thing you'd want to read? And that takes me to my next chapter. I may have an outline, but I allow my story to lead me once I get started on it and the characters are fully created. So to that extent, yeah, I mean, I think it's somewhat like a screenplay in that it's very visual and it's very tactile and visceral.
Yeah.
And those are all things that I love in reading. I mean, I mentioned Pat Conroy, and,
yeah,
you know, to me, he is one of the most visceral, visual writers in the world, and I love his way of making you feel like you're there.
Mm-hmm.
The writers as well, Jeffrey Eugenides is wonderful, and I love writers that do that. So, yes, I try to emulate that.
Fantastic. How did you go about in choosing the various characters?
You know, it's interesting. I decide kind of what, you know, I start kind of putting the pieces together, and the characters, you know, I don't mean to sound la-la here, but the characters sort of come to me. You know, they appear on the stage. I know that you look at life from a certain spiritual angle, and I think that by mm-hmm. spiritual, I don't mean religious or anything. I mean spiritual in the sense that we tap into kind of, it's almost like a channeling as such with creativity, and you kind of open your channels and things flow to you, you know, ideas flow to you, the characters that want to speak up. You know, of course, you sit there and you go, yes, I'm going to have a mother and I'm going to have a father and I'm going to have these brothers and sisters or I'm going to have this person. But a lot of the times those characters, the characters don't come to you until you're in the midst of it, and then it's like they just appear. And I've always honored that because I've learned through my experience that usually when characters appear or characters take shape, because sometimes you can have an idea of a character, and then as you're writing it, you realize it's changed completely. They've kind of taken their own reality and made it what it is rather than what you thought it was going to be. And
mm-hmm.
and that's just great fun. You know, you're following them around as they're creating this story that you've incited for them, but they're there busy, you know, filling in the lines, and it's a fun process. I think it's a really fun process. I always tend to fall madly in love with all my characters, even the ones that are horrible, just because they're so alive for me, you know, and
yeah.
So it's great fun to be with them, and during the time that I'm writing the book or editing the book, or always a little sad when it's over for me.
You mentioned just now where you look at writing from a unique perspective in the sense that from a screenplay, from a dialogue approach.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help you in writing from a man's perspective?
Yeah, because someone asked me, they said, how can you write from a man's perspective? Which I think
yeah.
any writer, I mean, when you think about how many books, I mean, please, how many books have men written about women? I mean, it's kind of
yeah.
interesting to me that anyone, I don't mean you, I mean anyone has any
yeah.
issues about women writing a man's point of view, because you think about how many books are out in the world written by men about a woman's point of view. And I think that if you live life and you're paying attention and you're surrounded by people of the opposite sex, your observational skills, if they're even remotely turned on, allow you to observe and be aware of the way the opposite gender in the characters that you know and the characters you come in contact with relates and speaks. And I think that when I originally wrote this screenplay, you know, Dan was very alive for me. You know, he was sort of a composite of men I knew, including some of my brothers. I mean, I have five brothers. I have five brothers, and I spent many, many years in rock and roll, and every single person I worked with was a man. And I'm married to a man, and I have a son. And so I am literally surrounded by men, and some of my best friends are men. So I have a male viewpoint at my fingertips. So it wasn't hard to kind of take those characteristics and those styles of speaking and those ways
mm-hmm.
of relating to things and giving them to the character in my screenplay, and it was no more difficult. Well, it was more difficult because I had to go deeper, and so
mm-hmm.
I thought about conversations I'd had with a couple of my brothers. I thought about the way my son responds to certain things. He's almost 23-year-old man, so he's old enough to kind of observe a more adult male perspective. I thought about my husband. You know, you borrow
mm-hmm.
and you picture things that the men in your life have said and done. I mean, someone said to me that she thought that Dan was more verbal than most men are, and more
yeah.
More analytical. And I said, well, this is based on, I know some very verbal, analytical men. I know men who talk more than I do. And you wouldn't know that from this interview because I'm talking a lot. You know, I know men who will just talk. I've had some wonderful relationships with men who were incredibly verbose, incredibly conversational. So I think that stereotype of men don't talk as much or they're not as analytical or introspective is just that. It's a stereotype. It's true of some men. It's not true of all men. And this character is very much based on real men that I know. He's a composite, but he's very much been real men I know.
So what is the story behind the book cover?
Oh, the book cover. I love my book cover. For your listeners, the book cover is the picture of an ice cream truck. And it's a photograph of mine. It was a very favorite photograph of mine. And in the story, there's a sort of a running theme, a motif that is used throughout from the beginning to the middle to the end. It's not a huge part of the story, but it's a motif that's revisited about Dan, the protagonist, has this tremendous affinity for the ice cream truck in his neighborhood. And it becomes almost a symbol to him of well-being, of feeling happy, of having a good life. And so that ice cream truck kind of plays a role in the story. So when I was thinking about what I wanted on the cover of the book, I had this photograph that I adore, and I went, this is perfect, because I don't think anyone can look at an ice cream truck and not be struck by some jolt of nostalgia. You know, I mean, I think all of us have some experience with an ice cream truck. And, you know, I know people when they hear that jingling music down the street. My stepdaughter, Jenny, is that way. I mean, she hears an ice cream truck, and she practically starts shaking. She gets so excited. And I know that as a visual, it's an appealing one to people. So, of course, you know, you want a visual on your book cover that's going to draw people in.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that this one draws people in, and it's a thematic visual for the story. So, in my mind, it was a perfect choice.
Very interesting. What is the most challenging aspects in composing the story?
I think it's probably finding the rhythm and the pace. You can create great characters, you can have great dialogue, you can have a great plot, you can have a great ending. But rhythm and pace, how we get our readers from the beginning through the middle and then to the end, it's very important because you can lose readers if you spend too much time jabbering about, you know, internal thoughts, or you. I'm reading a book right now where the writer keeps pulling me out of the main story and spending too much time talking about ancillary things that feel to me like it's the writer being interesting rather than serving her story. And so I'm finding myself kind of going, get back to the story. I think that's a challenge for any writer, because when you're talking about, you know, anywhere from 80,000 to, you know, 150,000 words, that's a lot of words. And you've got to find the right rhythm and pace. You've got to find the right story arc. You've got to get us from one idea to the next with as much propulsion, with, you know, make the reader want to turn the page, want to know what's going to happen next. And that's not easy to do. And you know, I hope I've achieved that. You know, you want to find that right mix. You don't want to cut characters off in the middle of a sentence, but you also don't want to wax on too long and bore the hell out of readers. So it's that is the challenge, and I think every writer has that challenge of how to get from the beginning to the middle to the end and keep everybody on the ride in intrigued and engaged. So I think that's the most difficult part.
How about what is the most rewarding aspects in composing the story?
You know, I know for me, I absolutely love the process of writing. There's something incredibly, it's just the greatest feeling. You know, it's sitting, you sit at your computer, for me, that's how I do it, and you literally climb inside a reality. And there's something incredibly uplifting about that. I always feel almost high when I'm writing, when I'm really engaged in the story. Really rewarding to get all those words corralled into some form that ends up being pleasing to you as the writer. Because I think as a writer, you have to love your own work. You have to love what you've written or you're in trouble. If you don't love it, I don't know how you inspire others to love it. And, you know, it's for me, it's like if you think about, you know, going and spending time with people you like, that's what writing is. It's spending time with people, even people, like I said, they aren't necessarily the best people in the world, some of your characters, but it's that exercise of creating life in its own way. And it's very buzzy. It's a very buzzy thing. And when you're done with it and you feel like, wow, I've put this together. I mean, I write articles and, you know, you can even get that feeling from writing a good article. You know, you've put this great idea out there. It has a good arc. It has a good rhythm. And bam, you ended it and you're like, yes, that's exactly what I wanted to say. And you hope it inspires people, or you hope it makes them feel something. And making people feel something is, to me, the most important part of writing, is connecting to those emotions. So that's, I want to connect to those emotions too, and that's the most rewarding part for me, is that emotional exploration.
How much of you is in the book?
Well, a lot. I mean, I would say more so with my first novel, After the Sucker Punch, because I very much gave that character elements of my life and aspects of my life experientially and stuff. She was completely made up. It wasn't my story, but I lend her a lot of my characteristics. With Hysterical Love, there's less of me in that it's a man. It's a very much a created story, but I feel like when I'm writing, I feel like I'm empathizing. You know, I've read interviews with actors who are playing evil characters, and like, how do you play somebody evil? You know, as an actor, you still have to climb inside that character and find out what makes them tick, and find a rationale. That every person, regardless of how evil they are, has some rationale. Even if it's sociopathic, they have some rationale for what they're doing. And as an actor, you have to climb inside that and find it out, figure out what it is so that you can play that character. And I think that's true of a writer, that even if you're writing about somebody that's nothing like you, you have to sort of climb inside them. And it's like the mother in Hysterical Love is this funny kind of ditzy woman, and she's nothing like me, but I feel like I can picture her, and I feel like I have such affinity for her and such a sense of understanding her worldview and the way she looks at the world. And I don't know, is that me, or is that me just having character empathy? Maybe it's more that than it being how much of me is there. It's, I think writers have character empathy, even for their characters that are heinous. And empathy is generally about putting yourself in the shoes of another person. So to that degree, I suppose every character has some aspect of you in it. So that's an interesting question. And I think writers would, I mean, I think character empathy is kind of a fun way of putting it, because I think that really is what it feels like to me, you know.
So that draws me to the question, do you write to entertain, or do you write to express yourself?
Oh, very much both. You know, I think if you're only writing to express yourself, odds are good you're keeping a journal, you know, locked up in your cabinet or your computer with no intention of others reading it. I'm not a journal writer, never have been, because I feel like if I have something to say, I want an audience. I know that sounds, I don't mean that in the egotistical way. I mean, I want it in the A to B way. I want to have a conversation. I don't want to sit in my room and just ruminate. I want to engage with somebody. I want to exchange ideas. I want to hear what they have to say. I want to say what I want to say. I want them to listen. I will listen to them. We'll have this exchange. And so I think the writing a book, writing a fiction book, I mean, writing a nonfiction book, which I've not done, but writing a nonfiction book would certainly be instructional, and you'd be trying to teach somebody something or share some concept or philosophy or instruction with somebody. But I think with fiction, as I was saying earlier, I think that I've used it as a way to share certain worldviews, certain philosophies, certain belief systems couched in the entertainment of story, of a great story. And so for me, it really is a great mix. You know, you're entertaining, but you're also exchanging ideas, you know. And I never want anyone to think they're going to be it's a dirge, or it's going to be some kind of preaching thing, because it never is that. I have no interest in that whatsoever. It's about I know when I read something and it's about a family and you get a sense of people experiencing new thought or evolutions or transformations, that's learning, and that's what I want to do too. I want to create some sort of emotional transformation through these very entertaining stories I tell.
So true. I find that all books, regardless whether they're fiction or nonfiction, are educational in their own way. It just all depends on what you want to get out of it. There's so much to learn from stories like yours because it covers pretty much, in a way, everyday living, family, and people can relate to components of the story.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I think one of the reviews I got for my first novel, After the Sucker Punch, was one of the most gratifying. It was written by a man, and of course the protagonist of that book is a woman. Mm-hmm. And he said something like, I can't remember his exact words, but he said something like, I feel like I've been trying to figure out women my whole life, and I feel like I got so much closer after reading your book. And I thought that was really cool in a way. You know, I felt like, because that's really what I wanted. I wanted to depict humanity in all its many colors and shades. And you know, I've had people say to me they don't like my main characters or my main characters are flawed. And I'm like, yes, they are. They're so flawed. They're completely flawed. They're completely human. I don't know one human that is not flawed. So I can't write about humans without writing about flaws, because we're all evolving. And you know, I don't want to write and I don't want to read about people that are void of humanity and void of human traits like being flawed. So, you know, I think that we learn from people's flaws. You know, we learn from the trials and tribulations that characters go through. And I think that's a journey that some readers really like to have. I know I do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing more satisfying than reading a story about a character that is going, I mean, I read this great book. I wish I could remember the name of it. It was about a man who was bipolar, and it was an amazing journey, an amazing, painful, horrible, you know, story. But you took this ride with him, and by the end of the book, there was some hope. You know, the writer wrote an ending that I like, where it wasn't like a slam dunk, everything's perfect now, but you saw a glimmer of hope at the end of it, and you felt like you'd been on this ride with this incredibly disastrous man, and it was quite the journey. It was brutal at times, but it was like you put that book down and you said, wow, you know, I've just had an experience and I've watched somebody grow. And I think that's, personally, those are the kinds of books I like. Those are the kinds of books that inspire me and engage me and make me want to read them, you know.
Wonderful. What would you like for the readers to gain from reading Hysterical Love?
I think a greater understanding about the struggles we go through. And by say we, of course, Dan, the protagonist, his struggles are not going to be the same struggles of every person. But I think through his journey, there is much to see about making presumptions in your life. I mean, this whole book is built on a presumption that you learn that sometimes the things that you presume about your mate, about your parents, about things that have happened, about the choices you made in life, you get caught up in these presumptions of what they are or what you're supposed to have or what you're supposed to be. And sometimes you discover those presumptions are not correct about all those many different things. And this book is kind of a journey of this character finding out that many of the things he thinks about himself and about his relationships and his family and his choice of career and all these things are built on ideas. He isn't evolving in his life. He hasn't allowed himself to embrace getting older, having, you know, new ways to experience his life. And through the process of this book, he comes to that. And I think I personally think that's a really important message, because I think especially when you're younger, you have such a set idea of how I certainly did. You know, you have such a set idea of what you think your life is going to be. And I think one of the agonies for many people in getting older is realizing, oh, so I'm not going to be a rock and roll star, or I'm not going to be the head lawyer at, you know, whatever. I mean, I think those are the things in life that, as we get older, kind of weigh us down because we had such high expectations or such rigid expectations of what our life would be. And part of living longer and getting older is coming to the realization that it's about going with the flow and keeping ourselves open to what might be different but might be better about a life that was not imagined. And that's really the journey of this book, and that's really what, you know, I'd like readers to get out of it, is some sort of inspiration and the idea of allowing yourself to go on a journey and transform and come to some new ideas about yourself and your life and the people that are a part of your life. And I want them to have lots of fun, laughing and being surprised and having suspense and just taking the ride with this character. So both things, entertainment and hopefully inspiration.
And that's what life is all about. It is a journey. It's fun. It's got humor. It's got drama. And most of the time, the dramas, when you look back in hindsight, there's always humor in it.
I know. Isn't that true? That's so true. Hey, 100%.
Where can someone go to buy the book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Probably, I mean, of course, the book is being sold in both paperback and ebook at Amazon. It's being sold at Smashwords and Barnes & Noble, a few other places, just in ebook. Probably the best way to track it down easily is to go to my website, because right on the homepage, the landing page, are links to all those places, or at least the links to Amazon and Smashwords are right on the homepage. So just go to LorraineDevinWilkie.com, and you'll see how to get everywhere you need to get to from there. And that's a great place to go to learn more about my creative endeavors. In terms of specifically my publishing, I have a blog called AfterTheSuckerPunch.com in honor of my first novel, where I explore publishing. You know, sometimes it's about me, sometimes it's about other writers, sometimes it's just about publishing in general, reviews, interviews, articles, blogs, you know, related to the arena of publishing, particularly my own, and that's another place people can go. And that, of course, is linked from my website. So my website is kind of the go-to spot. But certainly you can go to Amazon and put in my name, and my page will come up, and you can get all my books there.
Wonderful. Tell us a little bit about your endeavor in photography as well as being a rock and roller.
Well, you know, way at the beginning of this interview, I talked about how, you know, I hit the road with a rock and roll band when I was in college, and music was my primary muse for most of my young adulthood. I was dabbling in acting. I was at that time dabbling in writing screenplays, but music was my life. And during the 80s, it was exclusively my life. You'll see pictures on my website of me with big hair and lots of belts and bracelets. I was truly an 80s rock and roll queen. And that was incredibly fun, incredibly fun. And I had absolute conviction that I was going to be the next big rock and roll star, which, of course, as we all know, did not happen, or you would know that I had become the next star. And as I kind of aged out of what's considered viable in being rock and roll stars, you can be a famous older rockster. You can't really be an unfamous older rock star. So I transitioned from that into more. I did an independent film in the early 90s that incorporated my music. I co-wrote the film, and I wrote three of the songs for the soundtrack, and I performed one of them in there. And that was a big turning point for me. I sort of bounced from there into more serious screenplay writing, and got married, had a child. And then I started I had always taken a lot of pictures throughout my life. I found photography really a fascinating art form. And I decided in the early 2000s to take it more seriously, and I got a really good camera. And I started taking it more seriously and kind of discovered that I had a certain eye, sort of a storyteller's eye, which is not hard to figure out since I like to tell stories in whatever art form I choose. Mm-hmm. And so I just started doing more of that, and I pursued it much heavier prior to getting into this novel writing period. I have a website, a photography website, where people can go and buy my work, and many people have, and that's been incredible. Done a bunch of commissions. I have a beautiful photograph right now in a big gallery show at the Griffin Museum of Photography outside of Boston. So I do continue to work in that. I just haven't had the, you know, it's just you can only, you only have so much time. And I have put my energy into my getting my books out and marketed properly. But I will, you know, my site is there. I'm always adding things to it. I'm always, you know, entering competitions and participating in every way I can. So I would love people to go to my website, and you'll see a photography page, and that'll lead you to my photography website. And it's, there's a lot of great work there, and I encourage people to go look at it, and as well as go to my my SoundCloud page or my CD page, and you know, explore my music a little bit, because I'm always happy to share that as well.
You have been on this journey for a while, and
yeah.
I've always viewed I've always viewed life as a buffet line. So you have obviously tasted lots of the different dishes in life.
Yeah.
Do you feel that you have arrived?
That's an interesting question. You know, my immediate answer would be no, in the sense that I still have certain intentions, certain dreams of commercial success, of becoming a well-known writer whose work is widely read and known. That's a goal, that's an intention, that's a aspiration that I, you know, I'm still working towards. So have I arrived in that regard? No, I'm still reaching for that, to be completely frank. You know, some people say to me, look at all the great things you've done, you're such a success, and of course, many ways, but when you, I still have things I'm reaching for. And, but as a human being, as a soul in this world, I do feel like I've arrived. It's been very hard won. I've had just as crazy of twists and turns as most people do, with my own personal demons, my own personal mistakes, bad choices, dark periods, just like anyone has. And I've, you know, gone through a lot, and I feel like in recent years I have very much arrived as in the sense of my spirit, in the sense of who I am. And and that's been a hard one, and it's very empowering, and it's very, I don't know, I can't even think of the right word. It's a very wonderful feeling, because I feel like no matter what happens around me and no matter what commercial success I may or may not have, my feet are on the ground, I'm grateful for my life, and I feel extremely good about the world I've created around me. And I think that really is what... How more arrived can you be if, you know, than if you feel that? So there's your answer.
I just sense that from the voice that I hear and from the sense of things that you've accomplished, you are in a state of peace and harmony.
Yes, thank you. I'm glad. It's nice that you say that, because I think I am. I think that there were many periods of my life where that was not true. I was profoundly ambitious. You know, during my music years, I was almost rabidly ambitious, to the point that my identity was so wrapped up in being a successful singer-songwriter that if I didn't have that success, then I felt like I literally didn't exist. I do not feel that way anymore. I understand that my creativity and the things I do and the things I'm inspired to do are elements of me, are elements of what I am able to create, but I am who I am, whether those things come to fruition or not. And so, yes, that peace and harmony, when I say it was hard won, is because it's taken me longer than a lot of people, I think, to get to that place. I struggled with it for many years. I was frustrated and angry that I wasn't more successful, or, you know, felt that I deserved it, or felt that, why isn't this happening for me? And I see that a lot in the world that I live in, with writers, you know, being very upset that people are buying their books, or singers, songwriters upset because, you know, they can't get their record out or whatever. And I understand that. I can empathize with that. But I also have come to a place where I know that my role is to do the best work I can do, take all the steps I can take to get it where I want it to go, and then sort of sit back and divine nonchalance, as they say, and allow it to unfold. And that's where I am, and I'm incredibly gratified to be here, because it's a much more peaceful place to be, as you say.
Wonderful. Coming back to writing, what three things can you share with aspiring writers to help them sharpen their storytelling skills?
The first thing I'd say is read prodigiously. You know, just read every single thing you can. Secondly, I would say don't start by writing a novel. You know, start writing a blog, start writing articles, start writing short stories. I think with the self-publishing industry as it is, there are many writers, young and old, who have very little experience who are leaping into it because they can, you know, because it's available to do. Anybody can publish a book now. And unfortunately, what that's meant is that there's a lot of work out there that's not very good and not very well written. And I think that's made it difficult for the excellent writers, many of which are friends of mine, to kind of get pulled out of the pack. And so my encouragement to a writer is, if you are moved by this muse and you want to do it and you think you have a talent, find out, you know, dig in, learn the craft, read, write a ton, you know, write a lot before you put anything up, you know, on Amazon or Smashwords. You know, get your articles published, start a blog and really work that blog, and you know, really give yourself time to hone your craft and really learn how to do it. And then the third thing would be is to stay humble and learn, and do everything professionally. You know, don't hire professional people to design your book, to do your editing, to, you know, format your book. Be an absolute pro at everything that you do if you want to be a part of this commercial world of writing. And so read, learn, and be a pro. Those are the three things.
Fantastic. What is next for you?
I'm going to start writing this other novel I was telling you about. That's happening. Obviously continuing to promote both Hysterical Love and After the Sucker Punch. You know, I'm going to get this third novel done, and then, you know, I don't know, we'll see. You know, I might step back a little bit and start spending a little more time in my photography, maybe not. We'll see. You know, my hope is that I'm traveling around the world, speaking to readers and doing, you know, great events with other authors and being very involved in a sort of global exchange of ideas as a novelist. I'd love to do that. I love traveling, so I would love to travel with my books and speaking to people that are interested in reading them. That would be a great thing. So that's kind of on my bucket list to kind of create in the next chapter.
Fantastic. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
That's an interesting question, and I like that, you know, because I think it kind of goes hand in hand with what we've been talking about leading up to this moment. And, you know, for me, as I said, coming to that recipe has been a journey. And what I've come to for me, and I don't want anything to sound like a meme here, you know, or a self-help book, but for me, what I've come to is very important for me to pay attention to my life and to really be grateful and focus on what I have, not what I don't have, you know, and really decide who I am as a person and what I want in my life and the kinds of people I want surrounding me, and then create that, you know, all of that, all the things that I do, the choices I make to create that vision of a world that I want. And one of the things that I've learned, and it's really important to me to communicate this, is that our words and our thoughts are energy. And what we say and what we think has impact, not only on our life, but on the world that we live in and the world that we create. And there was a time in my life when my words were darker than they are now. And I think it's very important to be very selective and uplifting and positive about the words and thoughts we say and how we frame ourselves and our lives, and to focus on the positive and put our energy in that direction. And lastly, just always lead with compassion and empathy. You know, you can't go wrong. If you lead with compassion and empathy, you can't go wrong. So that's my recipe.
Fantastic. Lorraine, thank you for the wonderful recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Marie Georgopoulos. She's an intuitive counselor, healer, and spiritual mentor. Marie will be hosting and conducting her second Meditation for Moms series. She will be discussing how you can reclaim your real you with transformational meditation. Marie will also be talking about the launching of her worldwide consciousness movement, Meditation for Mom. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Lorraine, it has been a true pleasure. Thank you again and have a blessed day.
Thank you, Johnny. You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.